May it please the court, counsel.
My name is Dana Kurtz, and I'm appearing on behalf of appellant Sandra Valentino. We are requesting that the court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment in this case and remand the case for trial. There are four issues before this court. The first is that the district court weighed disputed facts against Ms. Valentino on the issue of pretext. Secondly, there is sufficient evidence that a jury could find that the defendants, Owen, Mayor Owen, and Village Administrator Paul Peterson, had final policymaking authority or were delegated final policymaking authority in this case. Third, there is sufficient evidence to present Ms. Valentino's Monell claim to a jury. And fourth, the state law retaliatory discharge claim. We provided a supplement to the court. There was a decision that came down on April 18th of 2008, Smith versus Waukegan, an intervening Illinois Supreme Court case that is dispositive of this issue. First, the district court erred when it weighed disputed facts against Valentino on the issue of pretext. The district court held that Valentino had produced no evidence to suggest that the village's concern about employment privacy was pretextual.
Could I just ask you this? Did she copy the timesheets openly, or did she hide that she was doing so? And if it's the latter, wouldn't that indicate that she thought it might be unacceptable workplace conduct?
Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record either way as to whether other employees saw her copying the timesheets. In this case, there is direct evidence that the retaliation, her termination, was a result of information that Peterson believed she was providing information to Bill Bermani with respect to the timesheet issue. 7 points. Peterson testified that she was terminated for these, holding up the timesheets and notes that she kept in her drawer about the fraudulent water billing practices. Secondly, Peterson stated to Valentino when he terminated her that he believed Valentino was making copies for Bill Bermani and taking them out of the office. This was from Valentino's deposition. This is an admission against a party opponent. This court recently held, as of last year, July of 2007, in Lewis versus City of Chicago, that this evidence constitutes direct evidence of retaliation. Quote, the court held an admission by the decision maker that his actions were based upon the prohibited animus was sufficient evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the defendants discriminated against Officer Lewis in that case. You also have Peterson's...
Well, before you go on, let me ask you this. Isn't it true that Peterson called Mayor Owen 2 or 3 days before her termination?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the evidence is, in defendant's brief at page 7, they actually admit to the chronological sequence that they found the notes on Monday, called her in, terminated her, and that it was later that they called, that Peterson called Owen. Peterson also testified in his deposition that the sign-in sheets were not private. These were sign-in sheets that were in the open, that were right when you walk in Village Hall. Everyone could see them, as he testified in his deposition. He also testified that there was no policy that restricts an employee from keeping copies. Additionally, if you look at the evidence, the deposition testimony of Owen and Peterson, it was Mayor Owen who testified that Peterson told him about the issue of identity theft. That's hearsay. That testimony never came from Village Administrator Paul Peterson. He testified that she was terminated for the timesheets. He never testified about identity theft, about privacy issues. And in fact, there's no testimony in the record, and defendants presented absolutely no evidence that this had any issue or effect on office morale. In addition, in Reeves versus Sanderson, the Supreme Court, as to Owen's statement of what Peterson allegedly told him, that it could lead to identity theft, not only is it hearsay, but in Reeves versus Sanderson, the Supreme Court held that the jury could disbelieve that testimony, that the fact finder's disbelief of the reasons put forward by the defendant may, together with the elements of the prima facie case, which the district court found was met in this case, suffice to show intentional discrimination. And the Seventh Circuit's opinion in Gazarkiewicz, it's G-A-Z-A-R-K-I-E-W-I-C-Z, the court talked about the fact that there was no evidence presented by the defendant of the disruption in the office. Here, there is direct evidence of retaliatory motive in violation of the First Amendment. In addition to the direct evidence, there is other evidence in the record in this case that requires the court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment. Timing. As this court has repeatedly held, Johnson versus Sullivan, Collins versus State of Illinois, Holland versus Jefferson, Lewis versus City of Chicago, the suspicious timing in this case is the FOIA requests were being submitted by Bill Bermani. The defendants admit in this case that they knew that she was providing information to Bill Bermani. There's evidence from Peterson's own admission that he told another employee not to talk to Valentino because she would tell Bill Bermani. Owen's statement after one of the FOIA requests was submitted that Valentino was going to get her quote-unquote butt canned. In addition to that, Ms. Valentino had worked for the village for 14 years without discipline, without issue, and it wasn't until she started providing information to Bill Bermani about the ghost payrolling that she believed was going on in the village hall, the fraudulent water practices, and Joseph Minotti engaging in improper and what she believed was illegal activity in the closing on his house, that she started to be retaliated against. This court has repeatedly reversed lower courts for weighing disputed evidence in summary judgment. That's exactly what happened in this case. Again, Lewis versus City of Chicago, the court reversed the grant of summary judgment. Gazarkiewicz versus Town of Kingsford Heights. And McGrill.
Did you also represent Bermonti?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
He did, and he did not take an appeal.
That is correct.
Was this case settled or was...
No, he made the decision not to appeal the case, so we did not appeal his case. But with respect to Ms. Valentino, it is clear that in issues of public policy, this case should go to a jury. The First Amendment is very strong to protecting employees who have complained, and in this case she went outside of the village and complained to Bill Bermani and was providing information to him about what she believed was fraudulent practices with respect to ghost payrolling and other issues. And the First Amendment protects that. And she should be entitled to a jury trial on those issues.
I have another question about this Peterson fella. Did he get a formal opinion from the city attorney about after he discovered these documents, or just telephone call to...
Your Honor, the only evidence as to that is from Mayor Owen, not from Peterson himself, that Mayor Owen testified that Peterson called, he told Peterson to call the attorney, Peterson called the attorney, and then relayed to him what the attorney said. Not only is it hearsay, but it's double hearsay. Peterson never testified in his deposition that he contacted the attorney to make the decision, and in fact...
So he didn't say that he... Did he say he did not? Was he asked whether he contacted the attorney?
He was not specifically asked whether he contacted the attorney. He was asked what he based the termination on. He testified he made the decision. He also testified at page 340 of his dep. I would say that Mayor Owen has the authority to terminate, and that authority could be delegated to me. Owen testified at page 18 through 20 of his deposition. And Peterson acknowledged this testimony, acknowledged this issue at page 84, that it was okay. Owen testified it was okay with him that Peterson, for Peterson to terminate Valentino. The defendants never claimed in this case that it was the attorney that made the decision. And this court and other courts have repeatedly recognized that the attorneys don't make the decisions. The attorneys advise. It is the client who makes the decision about whether or not to take certain action. Moreover, the defendants never even disclosed the attorney as a witness or a decision maker in the case. As to the second issue, the district court erred in holding that the deprivation of Valentino's constitutional rights was not by a policymaker. Here, there is plenty of evidence to suggest not only Owen's own admissions, Peterson's own admissions, but that he was delegated final authority to terminate. The district court recognized that you can establish a policymaker when the village board never reviewed Peterson or Owen's personnel decisions, which was evidence that was presented in summary judgment. We provided testimony from former trustee Terry Fiorenzo that the village board could not hire or fire, and he was a village trustee for over 8 years. In addition, the policymaking authority may be granted by the legislature, and in this case, we cited the village ordinances, section 2-115, section 3, that the town administrator, Peterson, makes recommendations to the mayor regarding hiring, disciplining, and discharge of village employees. Enough evidence in this case to submit the issue to trial on the issue of final policymaking authority or whether the village delegated the final policymaking authority to Peterson and Owen in this case. As to the third issue, regarding the issue of the Monell claim, again, there was sufficient evidence in this case before the district court on summary judgment that the village has a custom and practice of retaliating against people in violation of the First Amendment. While the district court held that there was a long list of people, none of these people could support their assertions other than a subjective belief that the village retaliated against them. Again, George Ellis gave testimony in this case that provided that he received a letter from Mayor Owen stating that he was terminating Mr. Ellis. Bill Brink, the head of Public Works, who is within the control group and can make admissions on behalf of a party, stated that Ellis was politically gotten rid of. If you also look at George Bova's testimony in this case, he was terminated April 2003, immediately following the termination of Sandra Valentino. He was her stepfather. He supported Kudra, the opponent to Mayor Owen, in the election. He received a letter from Paul Peterson, the village administrator. You failed to pay the $3.25 for copies that you requested. This was for his personnel file, and stated if you fail to pay within 10 days, your water service will be shut off. Again, that type of evidence goes to the issues in this case that Sandra Valentino had complained about. Paul Peterson testified that he knew that was wrong, and he did it out of anger. Not only these witnesses, but other witnesses have testified about the pattern and practice in this village by Mayor Owen, by Paul Peterson, of retaliation. These issues should be heard by a jury. They should be heard by a jury, not decided on a motion for summary judgment. As to the fourth issue, we provided the court with Smith versus Waukegan Park District, decided April 18, 2008, in which the Illinois Supreme Court held that Section 2-109 immunity does not apply to retaliatory discharge cases in Illinois. The court overruled Cross. This is exactly the same issue that the district court granted summary judgment on the retaliatory discharge claim. And therefore, under the Illinois Supreme Court's recent decision, that should be reversed. I thank Your Honors for your time, and we ask that you reverse the grant of summary judgment by the district court and remand this case for trial. Thank you.
Ms. Emery.
Good morning. My name is Ellen Emery, and I represent the appellants Paul Peterson and David Owen. Despite the myriad of facts and circumstances swirling around in this case, it is really quite a simple case as far as the two individual appellants go. Judge Hibbler was absolutely correct in his opinion granting summary judgment that there was no evidence that the reason that Ms. Valentino was terminated was pretextual. She had a running battle with another employee in the water department, and this battle included a completely unprofessional screaming and pounding bout in the office. It pretty much soured her supervisors from this behavior. when she began collecting sign-in sheets, which contained the signatures and identities of the other employees, she used the fax machine rather than the copier to copy them. So as to whether she did it surreptitiously or out in the open, it certainly was never addressed, but it does raise an eyebrow when you decline to use the office copier and go over to the fax machine to make your copies.
Well, let me ask you something about that, because I'm trying to figure out how her actions constitute theft of property, because she made copies, and she left the originals intact in the village's possession. So
right.
Where exactly is the theft?
Mr. Peterson, when he found that she had these made personal photocopies of the village's sign-in sheets with the other employees, saw that she had made copies for her own personal use and for personally keeping them. She didn't steal the actual property, but he obviously immediately became concerned about the morale in the office that someone is now taking it upon themselves to monitor everybody else's time.
Was her own signature on the timesheets she copied?
On some of them, yes.
Well, would she have a right to retain copies of documents that she signed?
She would. The fact is that as she was collecting them, Mr. Peterson did get a little leery because why you needed all of the information for everybody else that may have eventually risen to First Amendment protection, but back in 2003, it's still prevalent today, but somebody compiling other people's signatures is cause for concern. The contrary to what Ms. Kurt said,
And just to make sure I have the facts clear in my mind, she was not copying these at the fax machine where everybody could observe her.
Right.
Right. So she did. So it wasn't like everybody else knew about
it. Right. She went over to the fax machine where I guess people would assume that she's making a fax, but she's actually
making
copies.
And there was no evidence that she faxed it or tried to transmit them.
As far as the timing of the notification and the question to the village attorney, she was fired on Monday, March 3rd. The village attorney was called prior to that, at least the Friday before.
And is Peterson the one who called?
Yes.
What does the record tell us about what happened?
Well, it doesn't tell us much, and actually Ms. Valentino disclosed the attorney in her Rule 26A disclosures. She knew who it was. She could have deposed him, and the record isn't really clear. It wasn't developed much other than the attorney said, there was a conversation about Mr. Peterson's concerns and on morale in the office and her behavior and various things that the attorney said, go ahead and discharge her.
But here's my problem. The court stated that because Peterson consulted with the village's attorney before terminating her, that suggests that Peterson did not have the authority to set up policy for hiring or firing. But it seems to me that reads way too much into a conversation with the attorney. It's prudent to consult the attorney before terminating an employee in order to avoid obvious illegal firings. But why should that mean that the firing authority didn't rest with Owen or Peterson? The dots don't connect there for me.
Justice, if I may, could I defer that?
Let me explain something. It's only Judge. we three love being called justices, but some of our brothers have a little bit of a problem with that. So
I was always taught that that's what the respect to be regarded to you. So
well,
and it's true in the Illinois appellate court. That's why you're saying
that
in
right.
the Illinois
They're
appellate
justices.
Federal court.
We're just plain old judges up here.
All right. Judge, if I may, I'd like to defer that to Mr. Rewberry. He will handle the whole issue of the policy-making decisions. But the whole issue about whether she had protected First Amendment speech in whistleblowing, as it may be termed, to Mr. Bramante, and then she's terminated on Monday. Mr. Bramante's letter, the first letter, which is unsigned, anonymous, and makes a vague allusion to ghost payrolling, was mailed on Friday, February 28th, and the whole process of Mr. Peterson talking to the village attorney saying, you know, can I fire her, the timing isn't right. There is no way that it could have been a pretext for the ghost payrolling issue, because the whole timing issue is completely wrong. As far as the issue of whether...
Well, yeah, but, I mean, in your brief, you argued that the speech isn't protected in light of Garcetti.
Well, Your Honor, I'm playing also devil's advocate, because I'm going to, right now, either way you put it, whether it's protected or not, under Garcetti in the following cases, the question remains as to if she is a clerk in the village and she is monitoring people's comings and goings under Garcetti, if that's part of her job duties to, you know, watch when people are coming in and leaving and all of that, clearly not protected under the First Amendment as part of her job duties, and therefore it could not have been retaliation for speaking out on a First Amendment matter of public
concern.
What's
your argument, then, that the disclosure of ghost payrolling was speech as part of her job? I mean, where does that come from?
Well, because, Your Honor, when you boil down the facts, her saying there was ghost payrolling is not quite what happened. What she was doing was attempting to gather something to see. She was conducting her own investigation. Unlike Garcetti and the following cases, Morales, all this, the plaintiffs had found something and then acted upon it based on facts that they had discovered in the course of their employment. The cases are silent on whether gathering material and conducting your own investigation on work time, hoping to come up with something, which she never did. She just then took and said to Bramante, I suspect ghost payrolling. The things that she actively did in copying the timesheets and watching cars in and out of the parking lot and spending a great deal of time monitoring everybody else's behavior, is that First Amendment speech, that turning yourself into a detective? That we don't know, because, like I say, the cases all are people who had something concrete and acted on it. We don't have that here.
Well, why couldn't a jury reasonably find that the termination was because she was revealing information regarding payrolling, not because of some abstract need to protect employees from identity theft or to preserve morale?
Well, Your Honor, a jury could find that, but the problem is there was nothing in the lower court, and first time we hear about it here, that constituted pretext from the reasons that Mr. Peterson gave and what he saw going on and this escalating. It's a small office. It's a small town going on at City Hall where you have this infighting, and then you have someone who is copying things, and he's worried about what do the other employees say when you have one employee who is photocopying things that they sign and keeping it in their desk. Mr. Peterson had a reasonable belief that morale, based on her conduct previously and her ongoing conduct, was at risk. And,
gee, she was a 14-year employee.
I understand that, Judge.
Does that further indicate that the precipitous termination, you know,
Judge,
might have been due to her speech?
No, Judge, I think you can be a career employee for 40 years and do something on the eve of your retirement that would justify your termination. It's rare, but we've seen it. I don't think the longevity of her employ has anything to do with what she then decided for a workplace environment to create with going after Mr. Minotti and screaming at him and screaming at him, you better do your job, and then taking upon herself to just start monitoring everything everybody else was doing. If she had evidence of ghost payrolling and she didn't do anything with it, told her husband, told the newspapers, clearly protected speech. It's a matter of public concern. But that's not what she had. What she had was her own efforts to just see if she could come up with something. And I don't see where that falls within protected speech. And certainly not when Mr. Peterson looks at what's going on and says, we've got a problem here. So that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Mr. Rivery, you're going to answer my question, right?
Absolutely. Okay. May it please the court, counsels, members of the court. Judge, you asked a question about the court's decision with respect to the Monell claim, essentially the role of the attorney's advice. The court did highlight that in the decision. I agree with that, but that was not the only basis that was raised below by the defendants. Primarily, we argued, at least with respect to the final policymaking authority issue, that the two individuals whom plaintiffs claimed had final policymaking authority did not, in fact, have it.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
Did not have that authority, but rather it rested with the Board of Trustees. And we cited Propotnick, and a few other Seventh, as well as some Seventh Circuit cases, which stand for the proposition that the mere unreviewed exercise of discretion to hire and fire is not, I repeat, is not final policy-making authority. And the reason for that is very simple. In Propotnick, Judge O'Connor reasoned that if that were the case, the respondeat superior issue would raise its ugly head, and any time anyone did any type of act who was working for a municipality, there would be a possibility of municipal liability. So in Propotnick, that was limited. Here, the role of the attorney's advice is basically to show that there was not unfettered discretion and not unfettered authority to do whatever he wanted to do, he being the administrator or the mayor. So that is why the court, I think, highlighted that, to show that, you know, Mr. Peterson could not, standing there with the evidence in his hand, say, you're fired. He would have to, obviously, first speak with the village attorney to find out, you know, the legalities of the issue and whether it would be, in fact, appropriate to fire Ms. Valentino.
But, so you are not now arguing that the mere consultation with the attorney indicated that Owen lacked policy-making authority?
I am arguing that is one of the factors which show that he did not have it. That was one of the things that was raised. The court included that in the opinion, but there were other issues raised and other questions raised. And the problem is that plaintiff devoted nine-tenths of her resources in this case to, one, trying to find so-called ghost payrolling. It was like watching Captain Ahab chase the white whale. Went through all of these records. Tons of records were produced, three file cabinets full. Not one instance of anyone engaging in improper payrolling activities. The only thing they could find was one record was supposedly whited out, and another one looked like it had been changed. And no expert said that. It's just speculation on the part of the plaintiff. So the issue of final policymaking authority from the plaintiff's standpoint was really an afterthought.
Do you want to talk about this recent Illinois Supreme Court decision in Smith?
Yes, I do.
Versus Waukegan, because it certainly looks as if it requires us to reverse this to the state law claim.
If you read the first two pages, I agree. And
I read just the first.
I started reading the first two pages, and that's what I thought. I was interrupted. I had a leak at my house. I had to go home. But then I read it yesterday in full, without worrying about whether my neighbor was going to sue me for water coming into his house. And I realized that you have to go to the end, And it basically says that the decision is limited to cases that are brought pursuant to Section 4H of the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act. And 4H specifically authorizes, by statute, a retaliatory discharge claim where the individual claims he or she was discharged for exercising rights guaranteed by the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act. And the court specifically declined to apply the ruling to other types of retaliation cases. So that's how I read that case. I still think it is good law with respect to this type of tort. Certainly, they didn't say that this applies to any of the claims brought pursuant to the Illinois Whistleblowers Act case.
So the conclusion, which reads, we hold Section 2-109 provides public entities no immunity for retaliatory discharge based on the exercise of workers' compensation rights. We reverse the judgments of the appellate and circuit courts and remand to the circuit court. That's where...
Right. And I think we've got to remember, 4-H existed before the Tort Immunity Act. And the Tort Immunity Act specifically says that any rights guaranteed by the Workers' Compensation Act shall not be affected by the tort immunity provisions. Specifically says that. So that language shows that, you know, within the context of retaliatory discharge claims brought pursuant to 4-H, this decision applies.
Well, it'll be read a lot more than it, you know, than it has been.
But I mean, that's how I read it, Your Honor. And with respect to the issue of widespread practice or custom and usage, I'd like to address that, if I could, briefly. The court properly found that there was no admissible evidence to support any of it. And even those cases that might be borderline admissible, those instances, we're talking maybe two or three instances. And this court ruled a couple of years ago in Phelan versus Cook County that the word widespread has to be taken seriously. And at most, they've shown, with respect to Mr. Bova, a momentary threat of retaliation, which was admitted and which was, in fact, withdrawn. So there is no widespread practice evidence in this case whatsoever. As for Mr. Ellis, his position, and it's undisputed in the record, his position was limited by the Board of Trustees, not by Mayor Owen or Paul Peterson. And the fact that his position was eliminated shows really where policymaking authority lies in South Chicago Heights. The village eliminated Mr. Ellis's position. He was a foreman, and they decided to eliminate his position because he was a foreman overseeing two or three employees. They thought that was not cost effective.
And not because he's related to Ms. Valentino.
No. I mean, Your Honor, we produced, Mr. Ellis is not related to him. And I was speaking of Mr. Ellis. Mr. Bova is her stepfather.
Stepfather, I'm sorry.
And Mr. Bova himself was deposed, and he admitted he's never been subjected to any retaliation. Now, that's coming from the horse's mouth. I think that gainsays anything that Ms. Kurtz has put before the court, either here or below. So I think that it's important, you know, to remember that this case was subjected to extensive discovery, and it was basically all smoke. It's very interesting how the plaintiff shifts back and forth from, well, no, I was fired because I was going to expose fraudulent water billing practices. You've seen the record in this case. Have you seen anything in the way of evidence that shows there was fraudulent water billing practices going on? Ever established? No. And with respect to the so-called protected speech, we really don't know what it is. Half the time we're told, well, it's water billing practices. The other time I was going to expose ghost payrolling. And yet, Ms. Valentino testified she wasn't keeping those records to give to Mr. Bramante. She was keeping those records for her own personal use. That's her own deposition testimony, and she can't run away from it, try as they may. And the other issue I'd like to I guess not. The red light's on, so.
I'll give you a minute.
Give me a minute. The other issue I'd like to address is going back again to this notion of whether final policymaking authority was delegated to either Mayor Owen or Mr. Peterson. They cited a statute or an ordinance, and this was the first time it was raised. It wasn't raised below, and it wasn't even attached to their reply brief. In fact, it wasn't attached to the or mentioned in the appellant's original brief. And all this statute talks about is how the village administrator can make certain recommendations. That's it. Doesn't say he has the power to fire or hire. It says makes recommendation to the village president. And that's basically all it says. And that type of power, that type of authority, under no stretch of the imagination, satisfies the requirement for final policymaking authority as identified in cases like Kajowski and Proprotnick. And with that, I would urge the court to affirm the district court's decision with respect to the counts directed against the village.
Thank you. And Ms. Kurtz has how much time left? You have 6 minutes.
And why don't you begin with that Smith case and counsel's narrow reading saying that it's only applicable to 4-H?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Your Honor, in Smith versus Waukegan, the court actually held, we hold that Section 2-109 immunity does not apply in cases of retaliatory discharge because the employer, not the employee, ultimately causes the injury. Overturning Cross and the other decisions that relied on Cross, which is exactly what the district court did in this case. It would be against public policy and against the Illinois Supreme Court's decision to read that narrow limitation under work comp. And it was essentially after Cross that district court started dismissing retaliatory discharge cases based upon Cross, whether it applied to work comp or some other public policy issue.
And assuming we agree with you, if we agree with you on that, do you think we need to remand? Well, we would obviously reverse on the immunity and then remand. You don't think there's enough of a record for us to decide it?
With respect to the immunity, no. It really is a trial issue, Your Honor, as to the state law retaliatory discharge claim.
Well, if that's the case, why wouldn't, if the federal claims are all out of this case, why wouldn't the proper disposition be to have the federal district court relinquish jurisdiction over the state?
It's our position, Your Honor, that the federal claims are still at issue. There is direct evidence in this case.
Yeah, I understand that, but if we were to disagree with that and say that the Smith case only impacts the state law claim,
then the court should reverse the district court's decision on the retaliatory discharge, and the district court can decide whether it wants to maintain jurisdiction or allow the plaintiff to proceed in state court on that claim. As to the sign-in sheets, while there's an issue, and this is we provided in the record below in response to summary judgment, the sign-in sheets, I believe there are exhibits, they are to the response to summary judgment, exhibits number 12, plaintiff's exhibit number 12, also Valentino's notes, which was plaintiff's exhibit number 10, and some of the time sheets, which is plaintiff's exhibit number 11. But the sign-in sheets, if you look at them, they are essentially name, time in, and then they would put their name and time out. There's no other identity. Whether they signed their name or they printed their name, that's how the daily sign-in sheets worked. Again, Peterson's admissions in this case are critical. He told Sandra Valentino that he was terminating her because of the sign-in sheets and the documents in her desk, the notes that she had, and stated that he believed she was making copies for Bill Bermani. There's other evidence in the record. Again, the district court is not to make those determinations, only to decide whether there is a disputed issue of fact for a jury to ultimately decide. And in this case, there is. Sandra Valentino has always maintained that she complained about three things. Joseph Minotti, there's a written complaint about him improperly closing on his house, not paying the escrow, the fraudulent water billing practices, and what she believed was ghost payrolling or the abuse of time. And this court in Marshall versus Porter in 1994 held that speech involving time abuse is a matter of public concern. This court has repeatedly held that complaints about government corruption are a matter of public concern. She's a water clerk. As a water clerk, it is not within the scope of her duties to monitor employees' time. While we concede that the water billing, the fact that Joseph Minotti was not collecting and not shutting off water is within the scope of her duties, she went outside of the village and made those complaints. So that does not fall under Garcetti, nor do her complaints about the what she believed was Goh's payrolling practices. Again, as to the attorney, those questions were not developed because there were admissions by Peterson and Owen that Peterson made the decision and Owen testified that it was okay with him for Peterson to terminate Valentino, not the attorney. The consultation with the attorney is a competing inference. You can make a competing inference. It is purely speculation. We could argue that the consult with the attorney was to try to cover up and make sure that they had some pretextual justification for terminating her. Again, on the timing, the district court properly found that the timing, that there was evidence of a causal connection and motivating factor. On February 3rd, FOIA requests were sent. January 23rd, FOIA requests were sent. January 30th, a response from Peterson. February 3rd, a response from Peterson to another FOIA request. February 27, 2003, another FOIA request by Bill Bermani. February 28th, Bill Bermani sent out the letter to the citizens of the village of South Chicago Heights and detailed his concerns about the alleged ghost payrolling of employees. March 3rd, that following Monday, Valentino was terminated by Owen and Peterson. The incident with Joseph Minotti occurred back in 2002, September 13th of 2002, in which she had written the complaint about Joseph Minotti not doing the shutoffs and improperly closing on his house. And for the defendants to claim that that was the swearing match, that was the morale issue, that happened back in September of 2002, and Paul Peterson testified that she wasn't yelling. So there's competing evidence in the record that should be decided by a jury in this case.
Back to the mayor and whether he had final policy-making authority regarding termination, you rely on this 2-1153, and there's really no reference by the district court to that. What are we to make of that?
There's no reference by the district court. It is a matter, and I see my time has expired. May I finish answering your question? It is a matter of public record that those ordinances can be found online. We did argue before the district court the issue of final policymaking. We presented evidence from Terry Fiorenzo, the former trustee, that the village did not make hiring and firing decisions, that that was made by Peterson and Owen. Peterson and Owen's own testimony that they made those decisions. They did not have to get approval by the village board. So that evidence can be considered and should be considered on the issue of final policymaking authority and that it was delegated, which is an issue of fact to be decided by the jury. I thank Your Honors for your time.
Hey, and the court thanks all attorneys. The case will be taken under advisement.